Chapter 54. That magazine article of yours was mighty good. Up to your very best, I think. I enclose a book review written by Howells. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, October 2681. My dear Howells, I am delighted with your review, and so is Mrs. Clemens. What you have said, there, will convince anybody that reads it. A body cannot help being convinced by it. That is the kind of a review to have. The doubtful man, even the prejudiced man, is persuaded and succumbs. What a queer blunder that was, about the baronet. I can't quite see how I ever made it. There was an opulent abundance of things I didn't know, and consequently no need, to trench upon the vest pocketful of things I did know, to get material for a blunder. Charlie Warren Stoddard has gone to the Sandwich Islands permanently. Lucky devil. It is the only supremely delightful place on earth. It does seem that the more advantage a body doesn't earn here, the more of them God throws at his head. This fellow's postal card has set the vision of those gracious islands before my mind, again, with not a leaf withered, nor a rainbow vanished, nor a sun flash missing from the waves, and now it will be months, I reckon, before I can drive it away again. It is beautiful company, but it makes one restless and dissatisfied. With love and thanks, yours ever, Mark. The review mentioned in this letter was of The Prince and the Pauper. What the queer blunder about the baronet was, the present writer confesses he does not know, but perhaps a careful reader could find it, at least in the early edition. Very likely it was corrected without loss of time. Clemens now and then found it necessary to pay a visit to Canada in the effort to protect his copyright. He usually had a grand time on these trips, being lavishly entertained by the Canadian literary fraternity. In November, 1881, he made one of these journeys in the interest of The Prince and the Pauper, this time with Osgood, who was now his publisher. In letters written home we get a hint of his diversions. The Monsieur Fréchette mentioned was a Canadian poet of considerable distinction. Laura was Miss Clara Spalding, of Elmira, who had accompanied Mr. and Mrs. Clemens to Europe in 1873, and again in 1878. Later she became Mrs. John B. Stotchfield, of New York City. Her name has already appeared in these letters many times. To Mrs. Clemens, in Hartford. Montreal, November 2881. Livy darling, you and Clara ought to have been at breakfast in the great dining room this morning. English female faces, distinctive English costumes, strange and marvelous English gaits, and yet such honest, honorable, clean-souled countenances, just as these English women almost always have, you know. Right away, but they've come to take me to the top of Mount Royal, it being a cold, dry, sunny, magnificent day. Going in a sleigh. Yours lovingly, S.A.M.L. To Mrs. Clemens, in Hartford. Montreal, Sunday, November 27, 1881. Livy dear, a mouse kept me awake last night till 3 or 4 o'clock, so I am lying abed this morning. I would not give sixpence to be out yonder in the storm, although it is only snow. The above paragraph is written in the form of a rebus illustrated with various sketches. There, that's for the children was not sure that they could read writing, especially Jean, who is strangely ignorant in some things. I can not only look out upon the beautiful snowstorm, past the vigorous blaze of my fire, and upon the snow-veiled buildings which I have sketched, and upon the churchward drifting umbrellas, and upon the buffalo-clad cabmen stamping their feet and thrashing their arms on the corner yonder. But I also look out upon the spot where the first white men stood, in the neighborhood of 400 years ago, admiring the mighty stretch of leafy solitudes, and being admired and marveled at by an eager multitude of naked savages. The discoverer of this region, and namer of it, Jacques Cartier, has a square named for him in the city. I wish you were here. You would enjoy your birthday, I think. I hoped for a letter, and thought I had one, when the mail was handed in, a minute ago, but it was only that note from Sylvester Baxter. You must write, do you hear? Or I will be remiss myself. Give my love and a kiss to the children, and ask them to give you my love, and a kiss from SAML. To Mrs. Clemens, in Hartford, Quebec, Sunday, 81. Livy darling, I received a letter from Monsieur Frechette this morning, in which certain citizens of Montreal tendered me a public dinner next Thursday, and by Osgood's advice I accepted it. I would have accepted anyway, and very cheerfully, but for the delay of 2 days, for I was purposing to go to Boston Tuesday and home Wednesday, whereas, now I go to Boston Friday and home Saturday. I have to go by Boston on account of business. We drove about the steep hills and narrow, crooked streets of this old town during 3 hours, yesterday, in a sleigh, in a driving snowstorm. The people here don't mind snow, they were all out, plodding around on their affairs, especially the children, who were wallowing around everywhere, like snow images, and having a mighty good time. I wish I could describe the winter costume of the young girls, but I can't. It is grave and simple, but graceful and pretty. The top of it is a brimless fur cap. Maybe it is the costume that makes pretty girls seem so monotonously plenty here. It was a kind of relief to strike a homely face occasionally. You descend into some of the streets by long, deep stairways. And in the strong moonlight, last night, these were very picturesque. I did wish you were here to see these things. You couldn't by any possibility sleep in these beds, though, or enjoy the food. Good night, sweetheart, and give my respects to the Cubs. SAML. It had been hoped that W.D. Howells would join the Canadian excursion, but Howells was not very well that autumn. He wrote that he had been in bed 5 weeks, most of the time recovering, so you see how bad I must have been to begin with. But now I am out of any first-class pain, I have a good appetite, and I am as abusive and peremptory as Guiteau. Clemens, returning to Hartford, wrote him a letter that explains itself. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford, December 1681. My dear Howells, it was a sharp disappointment your inability to connect on the Canadian raid. What a gaudy good time we should have had. Disappointed, again, when I got back to Boston, for I was promising myself half an hour's look at you in Belmont, but your note to Osgood showed that that could not be allowed out yet. The Atlantic arrived an hour ago, and your faultless and delicious police report brought that blame Joe Twitchell powerfully before me. There's a man who can tell such things himself by word of mouth, and has as sure an eye for detecting a thing that is before his eyes as any man in the world. Perhaps then why in the nation doesn't he report himself with a pen? One of those drenching days last week, he slopped downtown with his cubs, and visited a poor little beggarly shed where were a dwarf, a fat woman, and a giant of honest 8 feet, on exhibition behind tawdry show canvases, but with nobody to exhibit to. The giant had a broom, and was cleaning up and fixing around, diligently. Joe conceived the idea of getting some talk out of him. Now that never would have occurred to me. So he dropped in under the man's elbow, dogged him patiently around, prodding him with questions, and getting irritated snarls in return which would have finished me early, but at last one of Joe's random shafts drove the center of that giant's sympathy somehow, and fetched him. The fountains of his great deep were broken up, and he rained a flood of personal history that was unspeakably entertaining. Among other things, it turned out that he had been a Turkish native, colonel, and had fought all through the Crimean War, and so, for the first time, Joe got a picture of the charge of the 600 that made him see the living spectacle, the flash of flag and tongue flame, the rolling smoke, and hear the booming of the guns, and for the first time also, he heard the reasons for that wild charge delivered from the mouth of a master, and realized that nobody had blundered, But that a cold, logical, military brain had perceived this one and sole way to win an already lost battle, and so gave the command, and did achieve the victory. And mind you, Joe was able to come up here, days afterwards, and reproduce that giant's picturesque and admirable history. But darn him, he can't write it, which is all wrong, and not as it should be. And he has gone and raked up the MS autobiography written in 1848, of Mrs. Phoebe Brown, author of Love to Steal a While Away, who educated young Wing and her family when he was a little boy, and I came near not getting to bed at all last night on account of the lurid fascinations of it. Why in the nation it has never got into print, I can't understand. But, by jings, the postman will be here in a minute. So, congratulations upon your mending health, and gratitude that it is mending, and love to you all. Here's ever Mark. Don't answer, I spare the sick. XXII. Letters, 1882, mainly to Howells. Wasted fury. Old scenes revisited. The Mississippi book, a man of Mark Twain's profession and prominence must necessarily be the subject of much newspaper comment. Jest. Compliment, criticism, none of these things disturbed him, as a rule. He was pleased that his books should receive favorable notices by men whose opinion he respected, but he was not grieved by adverse expressions. Jests at his expense, if well written, usually amused him. Cheap jokes only made him sad, but sarcasms and innuendos were likely to enrage him, particularly if he believed them prompted by malice. Perhaps among all the letters he ever wrote, there is none more characteristic than this confession of violence and eagerness for reprisal, followed by his acknowledgement of error, and a manifest appreciation of his own weakness. It should be said that Mark Twain and Whitelaw Reid were generally very good friends, and perhaps for the moment this fact seemed to magnify the offense. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hartford. January 28, 1882. My dear Howells, nobody knows better than I that there are times when swearing cannot meet the emergency. How sharply I feel that, at this moment. Not a single profane word has issued from my lips this morning. I have not even had the impulse to swear, so wholly ineffectual would swearing have manifestly been, in the circumstances. But I will tell you about it. About 3 weeks ago, a sensitive friend, approaching his revelation cautiously, intimated that the NY Tribune was engaged in a kind of crusade against me. This seemed a higher compliment than I deserved. But no matter, it made me very angry. I asked many questions, and gathered, in substance, this. Since Reed's return from Europe, the Tribune had been flinging sneers and brutalities at me with such persistent frequency as to attract general remark. I was an angered, which is just as good an expression, I take it, as an hungered. Next, I learned that Osgood, among the rest of the general, was worrying over these constant and pitiless attacks. Next came the testimony of another friend, that the attacks were not merely frequent, but almost daily. Reflect upon that colon almost daily insults, for 2 months on a stretch. What would you have done? As for me, I did the thing which was the natural thing for me to do, that is, I set about contriving a plan, to accomplish one or the other of two things. 1. Force a peace, or 2. Get revenge. When I got my plan finished, it pleased me marvelously. It was in 6 or 7 sections, each section to be used in its turn and by itself, the assault to begin at once with number 1, and the rest to follow, one after the other, to keep the communication open, while I wrote my biography of Reed. I meant to wind up with this latter great work, and then dismiss the subject for good. Well, ever since then I have worked day and night making notes and collecting and classifying material. I've got collectors at work in England. I went to New York and sat 3 hours taking evidence, while a stenographer set it down. As my labors grew, so also grew my fascination. Malice and malignity faded out of me, or maybe I drove them out of me, knowing that a malignant book would hurt nobody but the fool who wrote it. I got thoroughly in love with this work, for I saw that I was going to write a book which the very devils and angels themselves would delight to read, and which would draw disapproval from nobody but the hero of it, and Mrs. Clemens, who was bitter against the whole thing. One part of my plan was so delicious that I had to try my hand on it right away, just for the luxury of it. I set about it, and sure enough it panned out to admiration. I wrote that chapter most carefully, and I couldn't find a fault with it. It was not for the biography, no, it belonged to an immediate and deadlier project. Well, 5 days ago, this thought came into my mind from Mrs. Clemens. Colin, wouldn't it be well to make sure that the attacks have been almost daily? And to also make sure that their number and character will justify me in doing what I am proposing to do. I at once set a man to work in New York to seek out and copy every unpleasant reference which had been made to me in the Tribune from November 1st to date. On my own part, I began to watch the current numbers, for I had subscribed for the paper. The result arrived from my New York man this morning. Oh, what a pitiable wreck of high hopes! The most daily assaults, for 2 months, consist of 1. Adverse criticism of P. and P from an enraged idiot in the London Athenaeum. 2. Paragraph from some indignant Englishman in the Pall Mall Gazette who pays me the vast compliment of gravely rebuking some imaginary ass who has set me up in the neighborhood of Rabelais. 3. A remark of the Tribune's about the Montreal dinner, touched with an almost invisible satire. 4. A remark of the Tribune's about refusal of Canadian copyright, not complimentary, but not necessarily malicious, and of course adverse criticism which is not malicious is a thing which none but fools irritate themselves about. There, that is the prodigious bugaboo in its entirety. Can you conceive of a man's getting himself into a sweat over so diminutive a provocation? I am sure I can't. What the devil can those friends of mine have been? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.